Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined once again by Craig Joseph. He is a pediatrician. He's also the chief medical officer at AVAP. Craig, thanks for joining me for the news you can use.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
So COVID-19 is a hot topic. There's lots of things we could talk about, but one of the areas that I think would be worthy of discussion is around this tracking concept that people are suggesting. That tracking can be a number of things. It can be something that we install on your phone that tracks you and then supposedly alerts you to whether you've been in contact with people that may have been. I think there's an Apple Google concept where people could load this app. There's tracking that says, I'm going to monitor you and have some approval process that you have to demonstrate for entry or exit. There's even some countries that have tried to enforce this, notably India, that has said that its population must load this app, and that's going to be the definitive determinant of whether you can go into places and freedom of movement and so forth. And just on that note, from a security standpoint, it was less than 24 hours before that app was hacked. And doesn't matter what status you really have, you can show your green check mark to allow entry. So from the concept of safety and security and privacy, already demonstrating some of the challenges. Tell us your thoughts and what you've been seeing around some of the tracking apps and certainly some of the companies that are doing it.
Sure. Well, you know, you as you just said, you really have to break these things down into two different things. One is that app or an app that's used to tell you if you've been near someone who has later reported that they had a positive test for COVID. Meaning that theoretically you're at risk because you were close to them and for a certain amount in a certain proximity to them for a certain amount of time. As you mentioned, Apple and Google have put out software updates. Actually, I just updated my phone last night, so I have that new update. Now that's neither of them, Apple nor Google, are creating an app. They've just created the ability for health departments to create an app. And I think the vision is that each country will decide if they want to use this functionality. And then they will build an app that will go out to the Google store and to the Apple store, and people can then download it. And, you know, you have to do that, obviously, with some forethought, right? There's a lot of privacy, as you've mentioned, concerns about telling the health department where you have been. So the way Apple and Google have made this, so they say, your location is actually not known to anyone. So the health department doesn't know that you were at this place when this person who later developed COVID was nearby. What they do know is that the phones were close enough to each other, and they can send out a message again to you. The health department's not notified of your name. You have to then go and put yourself, either notify them or put yourself in voluntary 14-day confinement, so to speak.
That's a huge deal to ask somebody to say, hey, your phone said that you were potentially near. And yep. By the way, near could have been through a wall, because who knows where that physically was. And then you're saying, oh, you've got to self-isolate for 14 days based
yep.
on that. That's
yeah.
a big deal.
Yeah, and it won't, my understanding again is it won't tell you where you were. It won't say that this happened at Best Buy on Saturday the 14th. It will simply say that within the last, period. And the other thing, again, I mean, I understand the mission and I understand your skepticism. And I share some of your skepticism too. Every developer of an app that uses this functionality, again, it's typically, my understanding, supposed to be a country, but in the United States, it's probably each state will get to decide if they're going to create an app. That app, they can fine-tune the sensitivity. So in terms of how close does it have to be and for how long does that phone have to be in contact? We all know it's highly unlikely, although not impossible, that you could walk by someone and your phones will talk to each other. And but if you're just walking by, it's highly unlikely that you're going to be able to get COVID from that person. Again, not saying it's impossible, simply saying the likelihood is low compared to sitting next to someone.
And for clarity, what you're saying is that the phones will say, hey, you've been close together, but the reality is from a practical standpoint. And to be clear, I'm not skeptical. I think the concept is entirely appropriate. We have to track and trace. That's part of the sort of overall response mechanism. I think I'm just a little bit skeptical, both from a privacy and security standpoint, but also from an implementation standpoint. Look at Singapore, for crying out loud. There's a country that has really compliant people. You know, they follow the wisdom of the leadership there, but they got to what, maybe 20% adoption of their app that they were saying you guys should follow. And this is from a highly compliant population. I'm just a little bit skeptical that we can push this across. I mean, I'm not skeptical of the principle. I just don't think that people will follow and behave that way. And mandating it, as India has shown, is not maybe the smartest thing.
Yeah. Well, and to your point, which is, again, very well taken, my understanding is it needs to be about 70%, 70 percent adoption. So that would mean that 70% of the people in the United States should have on their phone, assuming there's really only two kinds of phones, an Android phone and an Apple phone, should have this functionality turned on.
Right.
And then to your point, you know, how operation. So if you don't get to 70, it's probably not going to do what it needs to do. And then it's not just that you need 70% of the folks to have it on their phone. You need 70% of the folks that when they get notified, hey, you were exposed, you need to go into your house for 14 days and not leave. And you should probably not be near your family members either. And we know you're feeling fine. But that's not relevant to the conversation. So that's what human trackers do, right? Human trackers will ask you, where have you been? So you went to this party, but you were more than 6 feet away, but maybe you weren't. We should talk to all those folks. What was the address of the party? Who hosted it? We're going to call them. That's very labor intensive, but that's how it's always been done. That's how epidemic tracking has been done for forever. And there's a lot of people who are very, don't really trust the from a security standpoint, Google and Apple, more so one than the other. But
take them out of it. I mean, I don't, you know, this is not me sort of going at them from a security standpoint. I think, you know, for the most part, I accept well-intentioned, I think, the practicalities of it. And I think what's important here is, as you highlight, and for me, that's the critical piece, use the technology as an enabler. It's a bit like, you know, filtering through the electronic medical record for all that data and presenting it in a form that allows somebody to actually use it. So it requires some intelligence and so forth, and using the technology to do that and then apply it so that the trackers and tracers, it becomes less of a labor intensive process and more of an intelligence or a knowledge worker who then says, here's all the information we have. I can quickly discount those things because I can see based on this information, not relevant, but wow, you were in this place with this many people. There's somewhere where I can focus my energy. So for me, it's a thoughtful approach. And that's the thing I would like to sort of see is, you know, a more thoughtful rendition of it. And maybe that's what you said. I hadn't realized that this was just a toolkit that people could take. So
it's really just an API, which is a hook that a company creates to allow other people to create software. So that's a thing. And your point is, maybe this is not the technology is not the solution, but it's a part of the solution.
Right.
And it can enable humans to do the, you know, for things that really are just busy work. Hey, with this data, we can throw these people out of the question. We're sure we're not going to need to chase them down.
So I was just going to say, let's talk about the other sort of app, because there's, as you described, there's two. So help people understand this sort of second principle.
That's a thing that's happening today here in the United States. So there are employers, I'm aware of it in hospital systems, I'm sure it's elsewhere, whereby every morning before you come to work, assuming that you have to go into a place to go work, you're required to answer a series of questions about your health. Essentially, they're asking you, have you had any symptoms of COVID-19? And then you're required to check your temperature and to record that. on an app. And when you do that, you get a green check mark, which will be available on the app, which lets you then go into the building and it, either pass a human security guard or you have to swipe something. And that's there today. And that's functionality that we're probably going to see a lot more of. Now, that's obviously, we're counting on the person who's filling that out just to be thoughtful. They're supposed to know that if they have a runny nose or a cough, even though it's likely just a cold, there's no way they should go to work, especially if they're in a crowded place, a meatpacking, a meat, you know, processing facility or a hospital or health, anywhere in healthcare. That's here. And that, of course, requires people to answer those questions honestly. But, one can envision that happening even more frequently. So are there going to be kind of health passports, as I've heard them called? Is it going to be that you can only go into the mall at a certain point if you've had a negative test or if you haven't had a positive test in X number of weeks or months? And then you need to prove that somehow. And what kind of third-party system would be, be able to
but
do
you're,
that.
You're adding some things in there. There's the self-certification, which is, hey, we're trusting you and asking questions. It's interesting. Yep. Had this discussion with my dentist, and he actually said that, you know, they have a pre-screening process, and he's already found it useful because when he's asked very direct questions of his patients before they even show up in the surgery, they are answering and saying, well, oh, yes, actually, I do have a fever, or I have, you know, a you're
freaking me out. I am surprised.
No, I think it's
hard. I guess I shouldn't be.
It's a checklist, for want of another term, and we know how important checklists are, even in the most basic of circumstances, like washing of hands in a hospital. So a checklist approach, but you added something else. So it's adding in some additional data that says, you know, have you been tested, how recently, and so forth. For those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, I'm the incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Craig Joseph, pediatrician and also chief medical officer at AVAP. We were just talking about the health passports and some of the additional data. So let's get into what additional data and, you know, are we seeing any of that? Are people getting tested and then that's proving or giving them some capacity to enter workplaces with a health passport, for want of another term?
I'm not aware of it happening. I'm aware of it being considered. And, you know, how would you prove to someone that you did have a test, right? So that's the question. How could that be done? And certainly one could imagine there are electronic health record vendors out there and others who have access to your laboratory data who could be trusted third parties that could convey that information. Something that where no one's really talking about is, so what if you had a test, right? I think we're finding more and more some of the tests that are out there are not accurate, have a low accuracy rate, for lack of a better word. And so not sure that even if you could prove to me that you had this test, that I should feel good about it. And if we're not talking about one of the antibody tests, we're talking about a test that, to check to see if you actually have the disease. That's good to know that yesterday you didn't have it. That's awesome. But today's a different day, right? And so even if the tests had 100% sensitivity and specificity, right, meaning that they were perfect, if they always told you if you had it or you didn't have it, they are only good for that time. And they are not good the next day. Not that, you know, they don't promise that you won't have gotten it since you last had that test. So it's a step in the right direction if you have that information. But certainly there's a worry, I think a very reasonable worry, that people will be excluded from work, from socializing, from other parts of society if they don't have the right check mark or if they haven't had the right test in the right time frame. And as you learned, as you mentioned at the top of our show from the Indian experience, very quickly, if you start excluding people, they're going to find ways to get around that.
And the flip side of that, of course, is that it can induce a level of surety for those that say, hey, I've tested, I'm positive, I can just behave as normal. And that's not essentially the insight that we have. It reminds me a lot of the helmets that were introduced in the NFL, which gave people an extra sense of safety around their head. And they became weapons, not deliberately, but they became part of that, and it sort of, caused more injuries as a result of the introduction of this safety equipment because people felt safer. And it's the same with this testing, and we don't understand it. I think that's the real message. And as you know better than I, okay, so you find that data in the electronic medical record, but not all data is created equal when it comes to testing.
Absolutely. It's another topic altogether. I wrote about it recently. It's very difficult, especially when all these new tests are coming out. The FDA did not require some of the laboratories, actually any of the laboratories recently, to prove that some of their COVID-19 tests work. So they kind of said, oh, tell us, you have to attest that you have the data. You don't have to show it to us or prove it to us. And they did that for a good reason. We needed tests, and we didn't have time to go through the months and years of time to prove that it works. And what happened? Some of them don't work. And for the others that do work, they're kind of deployed in a non-standard way throughout different hospitals. And so something that I've seen people struggle with, I've struggled with, is we're getting essentially the same test giving us very different results. In one hospital system, they can call it positive and negative. In another hospital system, they might give us a number. In a third hospital system, that result might be a text block, which just means letters to a computer. There's no discrete information that's a yes or a no. Humans can often interpret that, but it's hard for computers to interpret that. So what we've been seeing, patients who went to one health system and then are now presenting to another, and eventually you're getting back to phone calls and faxes to find out if they had that test. Well, we like fax technology. I know you're a big fan of fax technology.
But oh yeah, bring them back. Yeah,
that's where we're at with a lot of information. So, oftentimes patients don't realize they might even get a phone call, especially on COVID. People are giving extra special attention. Again, understandably so. And so you're going to get a phone call from your healthcare system, even if you have an app that has your test results on your phone, saying that you've had it or you haven't had it and giving you a little explanation. But what you don't realize is that they're humans and they're trained clinicians, and they've probably added information that they're giving to you that you may not get just from that test result. And so it's something that we can overcome, we will overcome, but especially now, it's really the wild, wild west of testing. Even if the tests are perfect, we're still getting results called a different thing, and one hospital puts it in this category, and another hospital puts it in that category. And yeah, it's made stuff much more difficult than it need be. I get it. It's just unfortunate. There's really nothing I don't think anyone could have done to prevent it, but hopefully we can fix it as quickly as possible.
But I think that the learning point from my perspective in this is that, lockdown is easy. Getting back to open safely is hard. And doing so requires help, support, capabilities of understanding the complexities of all of this in things that, for a lot of businesses, that's not something that they're even familiar with. They're struggling with, how do I deal with it? Do I have an app? What does this app mean? Does this mean I can't let people in? So it's a complex area that requires an enormous amount of help. We've got a few minutes left. I just want to sort of highlight something, and it's Shots Heard. So it's a group developed through a pediatric group that essentially came under huge amounts of fire from an anti-vaccine group because they had posted go get vaccinated for your primary vaccinations for influenza. I don't even know where it all started, but they came under just a withering attack, and they have a playbook now, and the playbook requires clinical professionals and scientists to get involved to help support practices, physicians. There's one a relatively famous TikTok physician. I'm not on TikTok, but she produced a really very clever video that was, get vaccinated for measles and this and so forth, set to music. And she just was decimated with what is just appalling status. I know you're on social media, something that you would consider doing. We can certainly put some of the links. What are your thoughts around vaccination and, combating some of the anti-science that we have?
Right. And I think that's really the point. I don't like the term although it's appropriate, anti-vax. It's really anti-science. So I'm a pediatrician. Of course, I support the science that shows over decades and decades that vaccines are safe and effective. I don't practice currently, but I did practice for a long time. And sometimes I absolutely encountered patients who are parents who were concerned and who asked for assurances. And, you know, my standard answer was, I would love to assure you that everything will go well, but I can't. And there are people who might leave this office and get into a terrible car crash outside my parking lot. That happens. That happens.
What a great analogy. I mean,
it does happen, and it's a risk. Yep. And so, I tell them, I can't promise you no risk, but I can tell you risk versus benefit. You're still going to get in your car and you're going to drive. Now, you're going to do everything you can to mitigate, right? So you're going to pay attention. You're going to have car seats. You're going to wear your seatbelt. You're going to have airbags. All of those things will help you stay safer while you're doing this risky thing, which is moving from one place to another place. Same with vaccines. So that's how I've always kind of sold vaccines, to tell parents the science. And again, I have seen people take Tylenol and have a horrible allergic reaction. So certainly possible, highly unlikely, but nothing is for sure. Now, how do you combat people who don't, sometimes bots, who don't want to listen to science, who don't actually want to interpret the data, do all the work that we have? I think this is a great idea. I have to say that I was not familiar with it, but I think it's great. And to some extent, you have to kind of, there are more of them and they have more, I refer to them as bots. They've got machines that can kind of spew out this, again, anti-science, anti-knowledge, anti-evidence. And so you're really not going to win from that standpoint. There is something to be said for doing your best to ignore them, if someone's coming at you with 100 made-up Twitter accounts, and they can do that every single day with 100 new made-up Twitter accounts, you're never going to be able to block them all and be done.
Right.
But, I think it's a fool's errand to try to respond to every single person that questions whether the sky is blue and the stars are real.
That the Earth is flat. If you haven't seen beyond the curve,
and that's a thing too, right? So I don't know how to talk to those. To some of those people, because they're not in, we have to have basic understandings before we can start to have a conversation. And I fully understand people who want to think about the risk versus benefits, but I don't understand people who say, I don't believe anything that, science has shown over the last few years. And I think that you, Dr. Pediatrician, are simply trying to make money off of me. Like, at that point, we're really not having a good conversation because you don't trust me. And if you don't trust me, then I can't really give you good advice. So there's to some extent, that's my, I know I've kind of swayed out of our line here, but on Twitter, it's the same way. It's infrequent, but it's happened where people kind of attacked some of the ideas or me personally and ad hominem attack. My best response has been to not respond and just to kind of ignore them and move on. And people who want the information will get it and people who don't won't. But I think that shots heard, that concept makes a ton of sense. And I definitely would encourage folks to explore it, and I'm going to explore it.
Fantastic. Well, as usual, we've run out of time. Just remains me to say that we'll link to the Shots Heard team. They're always looking for help and support. It's a group of science like-minded individuals that help each other out to support and, just defray some of that. I agree with you about not responding, but, it's important to make sure from a search standpoint that this stuff doesn't appear as the high-level searches. When people look for information, they should find science and facts. Otherwise, as always, delight to talk to you, Craig. I'm just wondering at which point in our episodes of news you can use, are we no longer going to be talking about COVID-19? I can't name that day.
We've definitely evolved, because the last couple of times you brought it up, I've acted like I didn't know what it was. And today I just went for it. I didn't even deny knowledge of COVID-19. So I feel like we're moving forward. We're evolving.
Craig, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.